So our meeting format calls for a guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will share for between 30 and 45 minutes before calling on people to share. During the open discussion portion of the meeting, we ask that you mind the time of your sharing so that everyone may have a chance to participate. And it is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chair speaker from Visalia, right? Yeah. Oh, you're from Solari. Well, close enough. Anyway, I had the great privilege of attending morning meetings at the Visalia Auto Club for a number of years with Bethany. And I really think that you're going to love the hope that she can share with us tonight. So, Bethany?
Thank you. Hi, I'm Bethany. I'm an addict and alcoholic.
Hey, Bethany.
I'm really honored that I get to share anytime I get to share at any meeting. So thanks for having me. So this April will be 5 years for me, coming up on 5 years sober, which is really awesome. I mean, all we have is today. So we all have today, and that's it. But, a little bit about me. I'm married. I'm a mama. I have 5 kids. Now they're 17 to 23. And, I'm a nurse. And I didn't become an alcoholic until later in life. I was in my late 30s, mid to late 30s. And, I had some medical issues and I needed to have surgery. So I was on my feet all the time as a nurse. And my doctor was prescribing strong pain medication for me. And after so many years of that, then the tolerance built and I started taking more and more. And then I had surgery and then they said I was fine and I didn't need them anymore. But at that point, that was not an option for me. And so I started obtaining them through other means. And then I detoxed twice because I'm a nurse and I actually am a child of addicts. And I felt like I should be immune to this because I know all about it. I was raised that way and I know all about it professionally. And I knew I had a problem. So I finally confessed to my husband at the time. Not like he didn't know, but I really thought I had, like, a really good handle on it. Like, there's no way that he knew. He was like, okay. And so I detoxed. And the first time, it lasted a week. Because even after the detox, I was such a wreck. And so the second time I detoxed, you know, that lasted probably, like, 2 or 3 months. But nothing about the reason why those substances quiet in my brain had been addressed in any way. And so that was just a symptom of the problem, as we know. And so I went right back to it. And when the money ran out for all that stuff, because at that point I was spending thousands of dollars a month. And actually ended up causing my family to go into bankruptcy because of it. We almost lost our house. It was a nightmare. And so then I was like, okay, for reals. Like, for reals. I got to get a handle on this. For reals. So then I'm like, you know what? Alcohol's not really a problem for me. Right? So this shot will help me, it'll calm my nerves, you know? I was thinking, because I was still dope sick. And I was just like, I'm just gonna take a shot and I'm going to feel better. And then that shot turned into two, and then that turned into a handle jug of vodka a day, and sometimes more. So I was in a constant state of being blacked out. I lost my job as a nurse. And I always laugh about how we've tried to control our drinking, because one of the ways that I thought I had a handle on it was because I would never do that at work. I would never show up to work that way. But I would be so hungover that I just wouldn't go to work. So then I lost my job. And I would always say, well, I never drove with my kids in the car that way. Which is true. So to me, in my mind, because this is what we do to ourselves, this is an alcoholic's way of thinking. I was like, I'm not so bad, right? I might be blackout drunk at home like 24/7. And I'll drive. Trust me, I'll drive. I'll drive right down to that store. When it opens at 6 a.m. or whatever time it was, but I wouldn't do it with my kids because I'm better than that. And I really, like, convinced myself that I had some parameters about it in my life, even at its very end. So I wasn't a drinker for fun. I didn't do it to have courage or be more outgoing. I was in bed or in my closet, literally in my closet, hiding. I was one of those drinkers, and I always tried to act like I was just sick. So my kids would say, Mama, what's wrong? Mama's sick. So Mama was sick for years. And it finally got to the point where I actually was very sick. And I would drink enough till I blacked out, and I would wake up in DTs, and I would drink enough again to black out again and wake up in DTs. And I did this for months. And there are months in my life that I don't remember. And on April 27th of 2017, I woke up, because every time I would finally regain consciousness, I would hate myself that much more, and then I would have to drink more to black out and not hate myself. And so it had gotten to the point where every time I would come to, it was like waking up in a nightmare, waking up in a nightmare. And I was like, just give me whatever it takes for me to not feel, to not even be conscious. It wasn't even, it was a full-on pain control escape from me. I wanted to be completely anesthetized. There was nothing about being functional in any way. Like, I literally wanted to be put under. And every time I'd come to you and have any kind of emotion or that adrenaline, I would just be in a complete and total panic. And then, of course, I would be throwing up, and I would be shaking really bad, and I would have hallucinations. It was horrible. And so on that day, on the 27th of April, 2017, I decided I was going to kill myself, because in my mind at that time, I really thought that if I wasn't there anymore, it wouldn't hurt them. It wouldn't hurt my family. I was the problem. I was the problem. I wasn't even trying to blame anybody else. Like, I knew I was a wreck. And so I got a box cutter, and I went and locked the door, and my children were at school, and my husband was at work, and I got in the shower, and I planned it all out. And I, at the time, before I lost my job, I was a nurse in trauma, which means that I took all the patients in that had tried to do these things to themselves. And I was like, well, I'm not being stupid. Like, I'm going to do it right. You know, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I had it all planned out. And I really, to this day, cannot tell you what happened, except for that the next thing I know, I had put the knife down and picked up the phone. And I called 911. And I, to this day, whatever your higher power is, I believe that my higher power did that for me. And in that moment, I chose life and not death. And I called 911, and at this time I was so sick and so weak that I couldn't get to my bed, to the bathroom, without assistance. I had damaged my body that badly. And I had had to crawl to get the X-Acto knife to get to the shower. And I still don't remember how I even crawled to get my phone, or how I even could, like, focus to even dial. And I told them, I'm sick, and I need help. And that's all I said. And I was having horrible abdominal pain because I had alcoholic cirrhosis of the liver, and my liver was so distended that it stuck out of my abdomen. And at this time, when I was so ill for so long, I hadn't eaten solid food in months, not even a cracker, literally. It was just alcohol, 24/7, for reals. And I had lost a tremendous amount of weight, and I was skin and bones. And so my liver literally was, like, protruding out my abdomen. Ambulance came and picked me up. and I don't remember a whole lot for several days. But I was very, very sick, and by the time I got to the hospital, my heart was in a rhythm that was not compatible with life.
Mm.
And so I spent a week in the hospital, and they made me physically better, and I admitted to them that I was suicidal, and I had a sitter at my bedside, and I wasn't even allowed to eat solid foods for so long because I was too ill that my body couldn't handle it. So after 7 days in the hospital, because I still confessed to being suicidal, and I was, I went to inpatient psych on a 5150. And I remember getting there and putting scrubs on, those blue scrubs, and I was mortified. I was mortified. Because I was the nurse on the other side of that, and now I'm one of them. And I sat there in those scrubs, curled up in a ball in the day room during the day with a blanket, and then in my room with a blanket, 7 days. Because the 5150 turned into more than that, and I got to be a guest for a little while. And I had many adventures in that place, and I met some very interesting people. And I still had not admitted that I was an alcoholic. And I don't know why that was just so devastating for me, but it was. And I remember sitting in the day room, and I was still on a lot of psych medications and on a lot of medications for my actual physical health. I was just so tired and so weak. I still couldn't eat food. And I remember the biggest, scariest looking guy. And he came and he sat down. And he was staring at me. And I was trying not to make eye contact with him. And he just kept staring at me, and I finally looked at him because I was really pissed at the world at that time, and I had no emotion at all, and I couldn't even fake it. And I'm all, what? And he goes, literally out of nowhere, mind you, I haven't told anybody anything, not even my name, okay? Out of nowhere, he goes, you ever have that feeling where you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're out of the booze? Oh, you gotta wait at least 3 more hours before those 3 hours are up and you're just terrified. And I was all, excuse me, what? Because it was literally like he spoke into my soul in that moment. Like, he didn't know that about me. And I'm like, why would he even say that to me? What a random, weird thing. And I remember crying. I remember crying. Because I thought somebody else on this earth gets it. Because I really, really thought that I was different and I was special. And sure as hell that I was smarter. Know what I mean? So I just thought, well, no one's going to understand. And women my age don't get into it. Especially mamas, you've got to understand. I literally was the PTA mom. I was the baseball mom. I organized all that stuff. I was always there for my kids. What happened? Like, what happened? How did I get here? So I came home, I got released, and the very first day, and I was still way too weak to drive, so my husband drove me, and I said, I talked to the psychologist, he said I need to go to AA meetings. Now, it wasn't court mandated or anything like that, but I just figured, if I'm going to live at all, I need anything that will help me get there, anything that will help me get there. And so it was literally me just grabbing onto a life raft while I'm drowning. And I was so embarrassed. I went to a meeting in Tulare in the evening. My husband dropped me off. And I remember sitting at a table that was kind of like this in a group that was like this in a house in Tulare. And I was like, I remember being so mad, like mad at the world, mad at myself, mad at my parents because of how I was raised, and it's their fault because it certainly wasn't my fault, right? Like, and I was just like, oh, man. And I was like, I'm not going to speak. I don't care. And this is a bunch of crap, and I don't want to hear it. And so they all went around the table, and it was just probably 8 or 9 of us, and they were like, they all looked at me, and they were like, what is your name and why are you here? And this is the first meeting I've ever been to in my life. I didn't even know how they worked. And I thought it was, like, kind of funny. Like, you sort of like, hi, I'm Dave. I'm an Oklahoma. You know, how are you, Dave? And I was sort of, like, mocking it in my head because they were actually doing that. And I'm like, oh, my God. And they were saying stupid stuff. Keep it simple. And I was just like, oh, my God. It's, like, my worst nightmare because I was just so skeptical. And I said, oh, sorry, I'm Beth. And Terry, who was the leader, he said, what is your name and what are you? And he was trying to get me to say it. I'm Bethany and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I told you. My name is Beth. I'm a nurse. And he was like, what are you and why are you here? You know what I mean? And I finally had to say it. And I know it sounds funny. And I had to hear myself say it. Because it was true. My name is Bethany. And I am an alcoholic. And it was like that moment where I had to hear myself say it, and I was just devastated, broken. And so from then, I went to a meeting every day. And most of the time, I went to two a day, and there were a lot of days that I went to three and four a day. Just to stay sober, because I had to feel again. And it's funny because I've worked with burn victims over the years, and one of the most painful times in their healing process is when the nerve endings start going back and they start having feeling again. And we have to really walk them through that, and with a lot of intervention to get them past that point, because it's very discouraging for them. They'll feel like they're getting better. Then they are getting better, and our nerve endings start growing back, and it's shocking how painful that is for them, and they just want to give up. They're like, I was doing so much better, what the heck, now I need all this intervention, what's going on? That's exactly how it felt for me. I had anesthetized myself for so long that I didn't feel it for years. And so all of a sudden, now I'm just sober, I have nothing in my system at all. Anyway, now I don't even have the distraction of work, right? Because I could definitely make that my addiction too, right? And be a total workaholic. I had none of that. So I'm like, you're telling me that I have to sit here and feel this? You gotta be kidding me. Like, that was absolutely the most terrifying thing on the planet for me. And I wanted to run so bad. I wanted to run so bad, run to anything. And, you know, besides the drugs and alcohol, I ran to infidelity. I ran to overspending. I ran to being a perfectionist and having some OCD tendencies. Like, I ran to whatever I felt to make me have control over all this stuff going on in my head. I really thought that I was different and special. And no one can understand. No one hurt like I hurt growing up. Is what my parents did to me. No one here is a nurse. Like, no one here is a college grad. No one here. In fact, we were talking about it when I walked in. In the beginning of my sobriety, I was still so intent on proving that I'm not one of them. I'm not one of them. And I'm ashamed to say that. Because I'm 110% one of them. I'm one of us. So every time I would go to a meeting, no matter how big or how small, there was always something that somebody said that somehow gave me life and hope that day. And I was like, that's so crazy. Like, people are just sharing their stories. Or why did that make me feel better? Why did that make me feel not so alone? Why did that make me feel like I could do it? And then when it came time for me to share, how on earth could I convey to somebody what God has done for me, what sobriety has done for me, what this program has done for me? How could I look at someone and get them to understand that there is hope, that there is life, that you don't have to live like this? You don't have to be afraid every day of every emotion that comes your way. How could I possibly get that through to someone? And that's not really my problem. My problem is just to share. All of our problem is just to share. just to share our stories of strength and hope, what we were like, what we went through, what we're like now. And I can tell you, in the beginning, I used to get really upset when I would go to meetings and people would be happy. I was really mad about that. I really was. I remember going very early on to a women's meeting, exclusively a women's meeting, and all these women were so cute, and they were dressed so cute, and they drove their nice cars, and they were so happy, and they were talking about normal stuff, and they weren't all, like, pissed off, and just sad, and miserable, and I wanted them to be because I was. Like, how dare you be happy right now? Like, my life is in shambles. My husband has one foot out the door. Our family is going through bankruptcy. My children never want to speak to me again. My only sibling has literally left me for dead. Like, I have no one. I have no career. I have nothing. There's nothing to be happy about. And I was so mad about it that I never went back. I literally never went back. Actually, to this day, and it's not even their fault. I remember people trying to get me to smile, and I just couldn't do it. Not even fake a smile. Like, I was so pissed off and so broken. And it wasn't an act. It wasn't like I was trying to be tough or trying to act cool. Like, I really was just so broken. Broken in my spirit and my psyche and my body. But there was nothing for me to be happy about. And I remember people saying, you know, people aren't going to want what we have if we just keep staying miserable. Like, we're supposed to give you hope of what it's like to be years down the road sober and that your life is reformed and your outlook is changed and you have peace and you have hope. All the stuff that I didn't have in the beginning, but I just didn't want them to be happy about it. And I was like, I swear to God, if one more person says, keep it simple, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. Oh, Dad. If one more person said that to me, I'm going to lose my mind. Because this is so much bigger. Mine is so much more complex than me. And I was just so angry about it. And so then every meeting, they would read the promises. And the promises were the most outrageous, far-fetched thing I had ever heard in my life. Because I was like, not only does nobody in here believe this bullshit, but nobody out there believes it either. Like, I got news for you, okay? Because I've been in nursing, especially in ER nursing, for a minute. And I'm telling you right now, ain't nobody out there peaceful and serene, and they don't fear financial insecurity. They don't regret their past nor wish to shut the door on it. Give me a break. That is a load of crap. And so I would get really mad about it. And, I have to say that the one that I still had a problem with all this time, because as I worked the program, as I went through the steps, as I just was like, I'm just going to trust the process, right? God knows I trusted whatever my dealer put in my hand. Whatever I bought from the store, I trusted that shit. It was going to make it better. It was going to make it go away. So if I can trust all of that shady nonsense, like, I'm going to trust this. I'm going to, okay, you tell me this is the remedy, fine, and it better be. It better be. I don't have any other options. I have literally nothing else. So I'm going to go. I'm going to try it. Fine, I'll try it. I'll try it your way. And I was all mad about it, too, and all prissy about it. Fine, I'll try it your way. Fine. Fine, I'll go through the steps. Fine, I'll make amends. Fine, I'll admit it. I'll admit it. So I did, but I did it every day. It's like when you're losing weight. You're like, you're going to lose an ounce, you're going to gain an ounce. You're going to lose 2 ounces and then only gain one. And then 6 months from now, all of a sudden you're like, holy cow, there's like 20 pounds now. I'm like, what the hell happened? I'm like, How did that happen? Because I was consistent. That's how it works. So after about 6 months, not even that, after about 3 months, I got into service. Everyone kept saying, if you're not in, you got to give it away to keep it. Give it away to keep it. Whatever, man. Fine. So I did. And then I started facilitating meetings, and then I had my own meeting, and I facilitated that for like 2 years, actually, at the Awana Club, and I just got caught up in it. And I just stayed with it. And there were a whole lot of days but I didn't feel like I got anything out of it. And then there were a whole lot of days where I would leave there just profoundly changed, just from a sentence from somebody else. And I remember thinking, there's no way that promise number two will ever happen. And promise number two is that we will not regret our past and we'll wish to shut the door on it. And I thought, there is no way on this earth that I will ever get to a place where I wouldn't change every minute of what I did. But I won't regret every minute of my life in addiction. And I have to tell you that I still stayed with it, even though I didn't believe it could happen for me. And just this last year, so my fourth year in this sobriety, I started learning how to forgive myself. It took me that long. Well, I was like, you know what? I did these things for these reasons, and I'm only human. And I really thought that I can make it go away. All that hurt and all that pain, I really thought that that pill and that drink stopped. And you know what? The worst part is that it did. Until it didn't. Until it made it 10 times worse. And then all those voices that had gone silent in my little head were magnified. Now they're screaming. That's what alcohol did to me. Really tricked me, cunning and baffling out into believing that it was a solution, and it ended up being the demon that robbed me of everything, of all my joy, all my hope, all my peace, of any belief in myself. So just this last year, I've been getting to a place where I started to believe that I could forgive myself, because I am one of those people that I will have so much grace for anybody else that's broken and hurting and made a bad decision. But I will have terrible. And I really thought that I deserved heartache and ridicule and persecution and pain for the rest of my life because I hurt the people that loved me and depended on me, the people that I cherished the most. I hurt those people the worst. So I deserve it. Right on. So on the scarlet letter, he dragged me out to the suffocate and humiliated me for the rest of my life because I deserve it. And you know, I found an A, not one person that ever said that to me. Not one person. Not one person ever looked at me and said, you are right. Wow. You're bad. That's bad. You're worthless. Perfect. You should beat yourself up. I have to say, there were people in my family that said that to me. The people that hadn't experienced that kind of addiction. But people in AA that know, not one person looked at me and said that to me. And that gave me hope. So I started understanding that forgiveness is a choice and it's not a feeling. I might not feel like I should be forgiven, but I am going to get up and every day choose to forgive myself. And I'll say it out loud if I have to. I'm sure to say it out loud. I forgive myself for my infidelity. I forgive myself for what I did. I forgive myself for all the lies and the stealing and the manipulation. And I started to believe it because I started to say it out loud. And I can tell you that I asked my husband this weekend before this meeting, what do you think is the biggest thing that's changed about me besides putting down the drug and alcohol? You are a person at peace. You are a person at peace. And I really never thought that anybody would look at me ever again. Especially someone that knows me like my husband does, would say, you are peaceful. You're not afraid. I'm not afraid anymore. And that is what the promises do for us. What AA does for us, we work it every day. And I have a long way to go. And I will be an addict and alcoholic until my last breath. But I will be a woman of peace and serenity, and I won't have to live my life in fear anymore. Because of the story, the hope that you guys have all shared with me over the years. Because you guys made me believe that I can do it, that I'm not alone. And if there was ever a chance that I could fit any of that back to things, I would be so humbled and honored to do that, because I wouldn't be alive today. I wouldn't know my children. I wouldn't be married. I wouldn't have my job. I wanted to share something that I never shared, ever in a meeting, ever, in all these years. But I really felt strongly that I should. And I want to read it to you as if it's to you. I spent my 41st birthday in the hospital. And that was my first day of sobriety. But in the hospital on April 28th, and my birthday on April 27th, and my birthday is on April 28th, and my daughter, who was 12 at the time, wrote me a birthday letter, a little short thing, and I have saved it ever since, and I will save it for the rest of my life, and whenever I feel discouraged, I read it. She said, "I want you to know that I absolutely love you. Anything that you may or may not do will never change the level of respect or love that I have for you. I know about your addictions, and I still and always will love you. You are so talented and smart and beautiful. I know you can try to get better, and I know you want and need help. I know it's easier said than done, but there is so much left in the world. I can't stop crying because I know you're so much better than this. I understand that your parents abused you and you've gone through a lot, and I wish I could change that, but I can't. But you can change what's happening now. I know it all sounds cliche, but we believe in you. I just want my inspiring, funny, outgoing, talented mom back. I want to be able to do fun things. And don't feel sorry. Just know that you can change." And I think every one of us is like that. You are so beautiful. You are so valuable. There is so much left in the world for you. It's not done. And that, I know it's going to be hard, and it is hard, but it's working. You work it. It works. Thank you.
Told you.
Thank you, Bethany. That was wonderful. It's been a great pleasure knowing you these years. Hey, so we do have a bit of a celebrity, another celebrity in the room. My good friend Jack is celebrating 10 years today. Stinking deal. And I can tell you, because I met him when he came in. Right, Jack? Just like me, man. We're both miracles.
Oh, yeah.
We're gonna start the sharing portion of the meeting. I think it might be appropriate to give Jack the stage here. And so let's do that, and then we'll come back to Bethany, and she can pick on people to share. So Jack, please share with us some of your experience, if you would.
Thank you, Bethany, for your chair. And I'm Jack, alcoholic. It's been 10. You know what? It's always been good for me, because I knew when I was an alcoholic and when I left to go to the rehab that I went to, I was finished. I drank most of my life, 39, and I was done. And so the quitting part was not bad for me, but the learning how to live differently was what I needed to help learning how to do. And that's what AA has done. Even though I never had a bad life, I had a good family, I had a good sister, mom and dad, I had a good job, I never got in trouble with my drinking, and I was just fortunate that God looked over me all the years that I didn't kill somebody because of the type of drinking I did. I didn't drink, I'm kind of like Bethany. I was married for 18 years, and for 17 years of it, I quit drinking back in the 90s, and I didn't drink. I mean, we did fundraisers because I coached youth football and high school football and different stuff, and wrestling and a lot of different sports for my kids and other kids. And my wife decided she liked other men, and that kind of, when I found out, it hurt, so I used the excuse to start drinking again. And I drank 6 years solid after that 18 years of not, but I was an alcoholic drinker before I stopped drinking in the 1990s. And other issues too, you know, but I like to do everything. And, but after that 6 years of drinking, I end up coming home, seeing Bill. My first meeting I was president of the senior union here in Visalia. And the first meeting I walked into, matter of fact, the guy's house that I was at tonight for the Super Bowl was in the meeting with one of my other friends, and ended up being two guys that I grew up from playing Little League baseball all the way through college, football and stuff. So that made it a little easier for me versus just walking into the rooms and not knowing anybody. In this 10-year period, I've experienced a lot of different issues with learning how to deal with alcoholics, with drug addicts, with other people that are normal, you know, because they got their problems too, and sometimes we try to fix them because we're alcoholics, and we couldn't fix ourselves. In the process, through this 10-year period, I had one of my friends, to get one that I was talking about tonight, die on the Rule 62 meeting, and fortunately enough, I've been in the military, I knew how to do CPR, and fortunately enough, there was a guy sitting next to me that was a doctor, and we were able to revive him, and they were able to get him to the hospital and save his life. And then I had my other two friends that, they died since I've been in this program. I guess. But they were both sober, they were both when they passed away. And I'm here too. Yeah, so it's been a rough, but good, you know. I still go to meetings, I got a sponsor, I've done steps, use my sponsor when I have problems. I use my meetings to when I get emotional, non-emotional. I try to help others. I do service. I've always done service. And actually, Bill helped me from the time I started. I've done different things for AA. I've always have some kind of a secretary or, you know, I don't think there's been a year go by that I haven't done at least 6 months of something on the treasure now of Rule 62. I volunteer most of all the functions, which are great. through it all, I have not had a drink. And there are other issues. I'm learning how to live life that I didn't want to live when I was drinking. I was too chicken to kill myself, but I didn't want to be here. It was very dark. And I had everything to work for. I had everything that I had a good job. I retired. I'll finish this. I retired. I got my contractor's license. I did a lot of good things. And all that's been taken away because of health issues now. But I have retirement. I have, I'm retired, you know, and I just have to learn how to relive life. And, it's good. I mean, but it's good because alcohol is honest. It's good because I read that book. And, it's only the book, probably, it's real funny, the book is, probably the only book I really read. Because, you know, when he's in school and he's an athlete, so I just go to the back of the book and answer the people past me because they didn't want me to fail because they wanted to play sports. And you could tell Dave, I was okay athlete back then. And, but I finished that book. I read it. I didn't understand it the first time I read it. I read it today. I read the Bible today. I read daily reflection. In the morning, I say a prayer. When I go to bed at night, I ask myself if I wronged anybody, and if I have, I try to make a sense of what's in day, so I don't carry that. You know, I always try to keep my side of the street clean. You know, it's not always clean, you know, because we have, shit happens. But, you know what, if I think if I keep doing what I'm doing, I might get another day. And I'm happy to be here today. Sorry we were late, but Rams won Super Bowl. But that's where I was at. And it's good today. I can go to Super Bowl parties and not drink. I choose a Super Bowl party that I went to that didn't have drink. But my life's good today. It's not perfect. I can make it better. Because there ain't none of us perfect. I don't care who we are. There ain't nobody perfect except for God. Higher power. And thank you.
Hey, thanks, Jack. And here's the late place.
Amen.
So, like I said, we're going to move into our discussion portion of the meeting. There are a number of us here, and if we all got a chance to share for 3 minutes, which is actually a short time to talk, we'd be here until Thursday. So, you're gonna do what you're gonna do. So, anyway, please, the floor is yours. And these are people who are here personally, and these are the ones online. And
I'll probably just kind of go back and forth between here and online, if that's okay with you guys.
Yeah.
The one with the glasses, yeah.
A Christian alcoholic.
Hey, Christian.
That's me. Love your story. I was looking at a lot of stuff in my soul. The last part was pretty hard. Because, my alcoholism doesn't seem like a French. I did a lot of fucked up shit with my kids. My kids have seen the darkest part of me when I was on drunk. They can wear a lot of shit out of my mouth that they never should have heard. My daughter was gone for this last summer at my mother's house. And my wife was at work. And it was my days off. The days the night before, I'd get dick faced. And I'd wake up the next morning and just get my son. And later, hungover, headache and all. And Netflix was my babysitter. And I'm 4 months sober, and I just hit my 4 month mark, but I know I got a long, long ways to go, but like a fuse, I don't feel like I deserve my space. I never felt like I deserved this shit. You know, I always blamed everything I did wrong on my parents. bullies in school, girls, everything. I blame everything on everybody. And it hasn't been since maybe this last year or so that even before I got into AA, I realized a lot of this shit is just me. Like, it's myself. I always try to look at everything from a psychological point of view and look into stuff, and I'm just wanting to get to that part where I can forgive myself for all the shit that I've done. And I don't know if I ever can, because I've jacked up shit from my alcoholism, and I don't know if I can ever forgive myself. There's stuff that I know I need to talk about with my sponsor. And there's a part of me that there's things I don't want to say. I know I'm going to have to say them. I'm going to have to bring this part. I'm going to bring that part to light. But as I think about it all the time, I'm like, I don't want to talk about this shit. I don't want to do this. But it's going to have to happen. And I just, a lot of shit you said, a lot of shit I went through. Right before I came into playing, few weeks or a month or so, if I would, if my shotgun wasn't in storage, I would have ended my life right there. I laid in my room, I had a shotgun shell, and I was like, I'm done. And then my stupidity, I'm like, okay, I got the shell, but I don't have a shotgun. That fucker's in storage behind everything, and it's 9 o'clock at night. Storage facility's closed. I'm too drunk to drive there, and I can't get inside. And it looks like I'm stuck here another night. When I woke up the next morning, I was like, what the hell did I do? My daughter's... That night, she's a little more thought of us. But I told her, your mom will find someone better. But we'll find a better dad. And... my first weekend, I talked to one of the guys over there. He said, dude, that's fucked up. That's what you did that. That's messed up. He goes, but you're going to have to forgive yourself at some point. You're going to have to. And I don't know when I'm going to get there. I'm trying to get there. I'm trying to make it better. I'm trying to know that I deserve good shit. That I deserve nice, that I deserve to have nice things, a nice life, a nice mental state, good friends, people who listen to me, who actually understand me. I know I'll get there. But try not to worry about that. Just try to worry about right now, this moment. And that shit is hard. Not worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow, but what's not going to happen. That shit's hard as hell. Because I'm a worrywart. I always worry about something that I shouldn't be worrying about. And coming to these meetings, talking to my sponsor, talking to my friends, recovery, it's always a constant reminder. We can do this. Just keep working. Doing your shit. And hopefully soon I'll be there. That's all I want. I mean, I'll end it right here real quick. Me and my buddy, Danny, we're over there. We went out to Three Rivers. We plan to go to Three Rivers. We plan to go to Three Rivers, go to River and Klein, go check out the river and go fishing. We went up there. And while we were up there, my car was already on its last leg, and my manifold exhaust leak finally popped while we were up there. But forever we get back home, there's a loud-ass old tractor-sounding car, and I said, finally dumped it. Well, today I went to a dealership, couldn't believe I was doing it. The whole time I was cursing myself. So maybe it was my higher power telling you, I'm tired of you driving around like this. I'm tired of you buying any fucking cars. I bought a new car today. And I'm still kicking myself in the ass for it. But, because I don't think I deserve it. I don't think I need it. But, the car driver wants to get me shit kicked out of me like these cars. So, if you try. That's what I got.
I don't have questions.
Desiree?
Desiree, alcoholic addict?
Desiree?
Thank you for your share today. I related to a lot of things you said, honestly. I was suicidal as well, you know. I didn't think my life mattered either, you know, and I was always hoping I would have the courage to commit suicide, but I never did, you know. I was, I had courage for other things, but not for that. So, it brought me back to a time when I actually, pulled a trigger on a gun that was always loaded, you know, but luckily that day, that person got pissed off. It was my uncle, so he got so mad, you know, because he's like, man, you don't even know, I always have this gun loaded, and the only reaction I had was pull it to my head, too, and just pull the trigger, you know, and, it's just crazy how, it's just crazy, you know, how we can be, there could be people like us, you know, and, because when I told, my parents found out, oh my God, they were like, well, you're fucking dumb, you're this, you're that, you know, and they don't understand, but, yeah, I relate to a lot of things you said. I remember too, I honestly had to hit rock bottom to kind of like realize that, damn, I don't want that life anymore, you know, because I was lost for a while too, like, oh my God, you know, and drugs and alcohol, and when I came back to a loving family, I didn't want to be here. I wanted to go out there. I was anxious, you know, I wanted to keep like doing that, you know, and I've been to meetings like you mentioned that you didn't want to be there. You were mad at everybody and everything. I was the same way. I was like, nice. And I just wanted to get the hell out of there too, you know. luckily, honestly, I haven't had kids, and that kind of makes me happy, you know, because I know I would have put them through a lot of things, you know, and now I actually see things different too. I've been sober for 2 months right now, you know, and I see meetings to me are valuable now. They weren't like that to me before, you know. And honestly, thank you for saying we're valuable. I really needed to hear that. I actually started crying when you said that, because now I actually feel like I am, you know, and before I didn't. So yeah. Thank you, that's all I got.
Thank you. Jared?
Hi, I'm Jared. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jared.
Thank you, Ben. I'm scared. I've been locked up. Jack Ridley. Your middle support. Hey,
okay.
Jared.
Thank you. Thank you. Matt H.?
Hi, everybody. My name's Matt. I am an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for your share, Bethany. Your hospital experience really took me back. I have tried several times in my shares to try to explain just how incredibly mind-bendingly nervous system rebootingly painful detox is. The words, I just can't convey it. There are no words to describe how it's incredibly painful. And the thing that's the scariest about the detox, alcohol detox I'm talking about, is that you don't know when it's going to end. I don't know how long it's going to last, and mine lasted 19 days. And I describe it like this. Arched back, clutching the sheets, head back, mouth open, eyes rolled back in the back of my head, silent scream. For 19 days, almost 19 days. It's so, and I had no idea that in a very short time when my alcoholism, my addiction was progressing very quickly, that I was buying myself that kind of a detox and a 17-year recovery. I'm 17 years sober, but I'm still in recovery. I'm still paying the price for vomiting every day for the last 2 years of my drinking. I'm going through surgeries for that stuff right now. So the price to be paid isn't just that. The price to be paid isn't in the hospital. If we survive the detox, and make no mistake, detox is deadly. Some people don't survive it. And the price to be paid in terms of physical and building a life back and gaining your self-esteem, and I'll close with this. Thank you so much, Bethany, for talking about self-love. The opposite of, well, depression is not fear of the past. That's BS. Anxiety is not fear of the future. That's BS. Anxiety is fear. Depression is anger turned in on myself. Well, I can't beat myself up every day, so I diffuse it. I depress it down. This becomes depression. This is self-hate. The cure for this is not self-love. It's self-care. Because the opposite of love is kind of going fast, but the opposite of love isn't hate. The opposite of love is I am apathetic, means I don't care about you. In order to love you, I have to care. If I don't love you, I'm apathetic. In order to hate me, I have to care in that way. So in order to love me, I have to care about myself in another way. And I have to learn how to care about myself. I have to learn to do what's best for me at the time. Usually, that's what I did yesterday. And it's making a meeting and talking to people and working with alcoholics and forever being in that, I call it the process of recovery and growing spiritually and emotionally. I know I'm covering a lot of ground tonight, but I want to thank you, Bethany, for touching on many things that really spoke to me tonight. And anyway, I'll pull up there. Thanks, everybody, for being here for me tonight. My name is Matt, and I'm an alcoholic. Peace.
Talking about going to the women's meeting and being upset. I remember when I first went into residential treatment, I sat in a house NA meeting, and I think I was reading like How It Works, nothing like emotional, but I was like bawling my eyes out trying to get through that simple reading because it hit me that I was in a 12-step meeting because I needed to be, and that was such a big blow to everything that I thought I was up until that point. Before my addiction and all my problems, I was a single mom for like 8 years. I raised all three of my kids by myself, and a lot of my problems in my addiction was remembering that, you know, I had been all that, and reminding people, like, well, you don't remember that I did all this, and it doesn't really matter because I wasn't doing that anymore. You know, I got so lost in trying to remember who I was that I became someone I didn't recognize. And, you know, now that I've been sober for like 150 days, I'm really starting to get back, not so much back to the person I was, because it took me a while to realize I'm never going to get back to the person that I was. That's a life that I had to mourn. I'm never going to be able to just be the mom to my kids with nobody worrying about, like, well, has she relapsed? It's always going to hang over my head, but I'm so much closer to the life that I want to live that, you know, I'm really not focused on the life that I used to live. I'm really focused now on just being a better person for myself and for my kids and my recovery. And I've really gotten to the point where I've gotten strong enough to where if it doesn't grow me, if it doesn't challenge me, if it's not beneficial to my recovery, it's not something that I'm interested in spending time on right now, because I don't have any time to waste. I don't have any energy to waste. I feel like I've wasted so much time in my addiction that in my recovery, I just refuse to allow that. But yeah, that's all I have.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Henry?
Well, just want to say thank you for sharing. I feel like so much of it. I just find it interesting how there was a time where I just felt like in recovery there was no way that I could relate to a woman, her story and her experience and her journey. And like the more I come and it's like a majority of the future are women, like hearing your story, I felt like, and that was me. Like, there was so much of it that was me. So thank you for sharing and being so authentic. For me, it really helps. Like, you gave me language that I didn't have to think that I guess I'm experiencing or going through. But it also normalize some of the things that I'm dealing with and took away the self stigma, because it's easy for me to start to feel like just me, like I'm the only one that has this much struggle or this much pain or this much hate or this much stubbornness, and so I just start to know it's just me and I get consumed in that. So to normalize some of this. But I think there was a few things that I really said. You talked about how when you first started, you really struggled with the whole education, how they do the same. That was me. And to an extent, that's still me. I really struggle with accepting the program as it is, and as it's been for years and years, and as it's worked for all kinds of people. But I realized that for me, it comes down to wanting to control everything, because I feel that I don't have control of everything, then that makes me very vulnerable. And I don't like being there. So for me, the serenity prayer is for the punch first. For me, it was more so give me the ability to change the things that I can't, so that things can work out my way, like I want. And so I'm realizing now that I'm trying to overstep a very huge step, and that is to surrender. Because in my life, in my experience, surrendering equals being vulnerable and being an active. And so that it's a very hard step for me to take. But I realized that the more that I try to fight the program and create my own program within the program, that the more struggle that I have, and most often I have to fall on my face to realize that hey, my way doesn't work, and it's never worked, and it hasn't worked, and you're trying to make it work here, and it's not working, so you have to stop doing that. And it's unfortunate, I feel that I'm so hard-headed and so stubborn, but I guess it's better that way. The other thing that really stood out to me was how you talked about the burn bit, about how when they start to feel, it starts to push back. Real excruciating pain. And just kind of connected dots for me and just picked them out of mind because here I am in this journey, this process, trying to do good, trying to do right, trying to be a better person, a better human. And it just feels like shit just needs to get worse instead of getting better. You know, everybody said it's going to get better, but here it just seems like things just start getting worse. And so it's like, when is it going to end? When is it going to get better? I can keep saying it's going to get better, but it doesn't feel that way. It doesn't seem that way. It doesn't look that way. It doesn't feel that way, you know. But hearing you share just kind of made me realize that that's part of the process. That is signifying to me that things are getting better. And it's not that it feels better, it looks better, but this is what it looks like to be human. This is what it looks like to live life sober. And we need to learn how to cope with this stuff. We need to learn how to deal with this stuff. We need to have faith and process this stuff and not go numb and escape and avoid this stuff. It's never going to go away. You know, you try to do that for X amount of years, and here you are 20 years later, still trying to, now here you are 20 years later, having to deal with this stuff that you were about to track in. So, I think you just really gave me a lot of hope that it works. It definitely is a process. I can talk about your 5 years.
It's fine.
So, definitely a process. But that's not a process. So yeah, I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Mike? Hey?
I don't know if he has a microphone tonight or not. Mike, are you able to speak tonight? No, he usually records, so he doesn't always have a microphone.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Was it Kathy that was at the on the telephone? I might have written the wrong name down. I apologize if that's the case. Was it Sam? Was it the 818 number? The one from Fresno? I'm sorry if I got your name wrong. Would you like to share? You just hit the pounds or the star 6 on your keyboard. Keypad. To unmute yourself.
You wanted to admit you were an alcoholic. I remember my first time. I went through time and went to Orlando, and I wasn't dreading it until I had to say it, you know, and I didn't think it was going to be like anything. I knew I was an addict and alcoholic, you know, but when I got asked to share one day, they went up there and said it. It's like, I said it and it hit me. And then I just got the big old lump in my throat, and I just realized at that moment, yeah, you know, like, I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. Like, I don't know what to say now. You know, and I didn't say anything. I just went and sat down. Somebody came up to me and asked me about the ride. I'm like, I just realized something. I'm very deep. I'm like, God, I got problems. You know, I got serious issues and stuff, and I've been in this home for 2 weeks, and like I had like a little one-on-one, like meeting with him or whatever, didn't share, you know, just with him and explain it to him. He's like, well, you should say all that up there. And I'm like, is what it is, but it was a very sincere, serious, devastating moment helped me in when I realized that. The next day I went to my guy, my counselor, and I explained to him about it, you know, and he was like, let's find a way first. I didn't sponsor anything at that point. You know, that admittance and realizing it, now you got a stranger and work on it, you know, and it's like I'm getting out of those ill feelings or those side feelings or, you know, the anxieties, just even thinking about the first time I said it, like right now, it's happening right now. That was 7 years ago, when I first said it, you know, I'm not an addict. The second thing was that, before, my 6-year-old daughter, I live in a sober living environment, you know, it's my kids, you know, girls with their grandma, and last year, I've had a few speed bumps, but last year, at one point in time, my 6-year-old told me I was on her grandma's back porch, you can hung over, and sick from other substances and stuff, you know, I did everything on our disposal. 9 o'clock in the morning, she came out the back door to go feed her rabbits. I'm sitting on the picnic bench, going to the backyard, and she looks up at me and she's like, "Dad, you're sick. I'm all right. I'm okay. You know, I have a kid right next to me, and I wasn't all right." And she knew I wasn't all right. At that point in time, God was intervening in my life through her. You know, and she knew about time, the place I've been through, and my dad was sick, and I was crying, and she wiped tears off my face. I put his blood in both feet and it'll be all right. She sat down next to me, and she started crying with me. Yeah. My dad and I reunited at the time. You know, and I'm like, what are you saying? She's like, I'm not reunited at the time. Just come back in time. You're not sick, you know? And, we just had a moment, you know, and I called Pine, I went back, hit a speed bump, you know, after that, 6 months after that or something, but this last weekend, she asked me, she's like, "Dad, you still sick?" And it's hard to explain to a 6-year-old, you know, that I'm sick. I know I've become, you know, she'd be older and stuff, but I don't feel sick, but when that time comes, you know, Dad's always going to be sick, I'm going to be fine. She's like, she's okay with me being at Pine and doing these things that I'm not as sick as I was, you know, a year ago. Kind of got lost in that moment there, but that's all I got.
Thanks, Dave. So, I'm afraid we're just about out of time, but let's be sure to let Bethany know how much we appreciate it.